Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Michelle Nichon, founder of Wholesome Wave, is a 21st century American revolutionary. In collaboration with Paul Newman, Michelle has effected big change in food justice while concurrently running a James Beard Award-winning restaurant in Connecticut. Michelle joins us on this week's Louisiana Eats with an inside look at social justice through food in contemporary America. Then, we hear from Cajun revolutionaries Toby Rodriguez and Brian Kaiser, who are keeping Southwest Louisiana food traditions alive while putting a new spin on the age-old cuisine. And we cook up some shrimp spiders, a dish previously eaten only by Louisiana shrimpers. We're making waves and changing ways on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hi, I'm Michelle Nichon. I'm CEO of Wholesome Wave, a chef, and I love local food.
Michelle Nichon served as the honorary chairman of this year's Farm to Table International Symposium. Originally from Illinois, Michelle's relationship with food began on his grandfather's farm, where he spent many a summer sweating beneath the warm rays of the Midwestern sun.
My mom and dad used to send us down every summer because they worked hard and were lower middle class and struggled with income, so they would send us down for 6 to 8 weeks every summer to work what was left of my grandpa's farm because he couldn't afford the farmhands. She wanted us to learn chores and how to deal with animals and get fresh air and all that good jazz, and then she and my dad would take on extra work in the summer back home. So until my grandpa passed when I was 16 years old, that's how I spent my summertime. So I did kind of grow up on the farm.
Those summers stuck with him. Just like anyone else who's done farm work, Michelle developed an unwavering work ethic he'd put to the test at a relatively young age. At a time when most of us are planning to leave home, Michelle found himself in a similar situation, but he didn't have a choice.
So my mom and dad fell on hard times right when I was graduating high school. My older brother was graduated for a year, and they had to downsize and sell the house, and we had a younger brother and a younger sister, and my mom and dad had the talk with Steve and I that we really needed to go out on our own. And my mom looked to me, because I was the one who loved food. All my aunts and uncles could cook and pickle and can and hunt and butcher and all that stuff, and she said, "We're going to go get you a job in a restaurant, because at least you'll eat." She said, "You'll get two meals. You get one at the beginning of the shift, and you'll get one at the end of the shift, and at least I know that you'll be fed." So my first job was as a breakfast cook at a truck stop on the Illinois-Wisconsin border called Center's Truck Stop on Russell Road. It's still there to this day. So that's how I got into the business. One thing led to another, and because I knew how to butcher and cook and all of those other things, I moved very, very rapidly.
And you found that you loved it. You must have loved it.
I absolutely loved it. I adored it to the depth of my soul. At the time, I really wanted to be a musician, because my mother was also very musical. She was a torch singer and very, very talented. But there was just no money in it. And certainly where there's no money, there's no food. So when I first got the job in the restaurant, I was a little reluctant. But then I started noticing a lot of similarities between the creative process of cooking and the creative process of musing, the collaborative process of that. If you want to be in a band, if you don't get along with everybody, the music's not going to be great. When it is great, the adoring public, whether it's concert goers or people sitting in a restaurant, really show genuine appreciation. So I just very, very quickly decided I was going to be a chef someday.
So 35 years ago, you were one of the very first people who ever sought out a farm-to-table connectivity. Tell us about how that was back then, and what were the obstacles you faced?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did it assuming that it would be easier than it was, because of the way I had been raised. And even, you know, in Des Plaines, Illinois, my mom dug up the whole back and side yard and planted a garden. We canned, we pickled, we did our thing. I just thought that was normal. as a naive kid, I thought it was normal. I had no idea that it was a nearly extinct culture, right? I had no idea. So I started working in restaurants, and my big idea, my bright idea is I'll be a chef someday, and I'll be a better chef than anybody else, because the food coming in the back door of these restaurants is absolute crap. Pink tomatoes, perfectly round, tastes like not tomatoes. So I'll just go find farmers and I'll buy food from them, and then I'll kick all the other chefs' ass. Right? So I got my first gig as a chef at the Fleur-de-Lis in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1981, and I immediately did the short 20-minute drive out to Oconomowoc, where all the farms are, knocking on doors, getting doors slammed in my face, seeing all the corn, seeing all the soy, assuming there has to be a family vegetable plot somewhere, and found that it wasn't there. And I remember, you know, this one young family invited me in for coffee, and the wife had just inherited the farm from her parents. And she said, you know, until I was like 8 years old, we used to grow specialty crops, she called them. But we went to corn and soy. But, you know, there's this asparagus patch down by the access road. It's just lasted all these years. Take all you want. So it was my first farm-to-table acquisition ever, but it was also my only one that year. Nobody was growing anything, and it shocked me. It shocked me. So I kind of got angry first at myself that I was so naive as to think that all I had to do was find a farm and I'd find good food. And I became friends with these young farmers who said the money isn't in corn and soy, and telling me the woes that they and their farming communities were going through. I'm like, someone's got to do something about this. And I didn't know, you know, Alice was doing it in California. Nora Puyam was doing it in the mid-Atlantic in D.C. But we were all these lone little kind of islanders out there believing that food was that important and trying to get it done. And we would make 20, 30 phone calls and have very little of the food that we were serving in the restaurant come from any kind of a local farmer. It was really a wasteland at that time.
And then it becomes a little easier, and you are accessing local food. What was the customer's reaction to the fact that you had some local food from down the dirt road coming in the back door?
Well, the first was like, they didn't want it. They didn't want it. They thought I was like some kind of a weird hippie. They're like, you're bizarre, man. You're picking your own asparagus. We had to stop talking about it, because I wasn't going to stop trying to buy that food. I wasn't going to do it. I knew it was better. I knew I could trust these people. I could go and see how it was being grown, and I could have conversations. I knew enough about farming to have an intelligent conversation with somebody in the way that they were growing stuff. And I'm like, I'm not going to not do that. I owe it to my grandpa. You know, I owe it to my mom. I owe it to my dad. We're just not going to talk about it. So people would be like, oh my God, this is the most amazing asparagus in the world. What did you do to it? I'm like, kitchen secret, you know.
This
pork was like amazing. What'd you do? I have some really great staff in the back, and boy, do they know how to do pork. You just couldn't talk about it. Wow. People thought that all the produce that came in boxes, and they would see people in the grocery store in the produce aisle unloading these heads of romaine lettuce from a box, that it had gone through some kind of miraculous process that made it clean and pure, you know. So it was really a heavy lift. So not only were we, you know, making uncountable phone calls to have like 5% of our stuff come from local producers, we had to lie about it. By omission, we were not being genuine, and it was weird, you know. So I call those kind of like semi-dark ages, and I'm glad they're over.
But track how things changed. The change.
All right, okay, so I would say about 15 years into it, I actually was getting to a point of what I felt was a modicum of success from the systems perspective, because I could make the same amount of phone calls and have like 40 to 50% of my stuff come from within a reasonable distance. So that was the other kind of semi-dark ages, because I could talk about it now and people would say, oh, how interesting, and then just not even seem like it registered beyond how interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And I would go out to tables and talk to people about it and try to get them all enthusiastic about it and stuff like that. And they're like, well, I really like having raspberries in February. It's just, you know, just, so it just, I remember, you know, going through this phase of coming home to Lori, my beautiful wife, and saying, honey, I don't know if I can keep doing this. Nobody cares. You know, we learned that there was this kind of underground movement of us.
Yes, you all were a cult.
Yes, it's really so freaky, but people still think that way of us. So it's like there's this movement, but people weren't caring. I'm like, we're really doing this for future generations. And we would talk amongst ourselves and say, so we're going to just accept and we're going to bite this bullet. We're doing this for future generations, and we're going to keep doing stuff that is really hard to do, that people just don't care about because we believe that it's important, right? So, you know, all of a sudden, 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, 10 years ago, boom, it started becoming important. Farmers market started popping up all over the damn place. And I think a lot of it had to do with people making the connection between food and human health. That was the big public awareness thing that happened. And it happened to me, you know, 20 years ago at that same time that I was convinced we were doing it for future generations is when my son Chris, who is now 25, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And the doctor went to great pains to tell me that what we did with his diet would have more to do with his long-term outcome than anything else. So I came to the understanding of the connection between food and human health. But what was interesting is that kind of like Jane Q. Public would go out and start shopping at farmers markets and then just saying, I don't care if anybody studies how I feel, but I just feel better. My food tastes better. I feel really great about the people I'm buying my food from. I've made new friends. There's direct human connection, this connection of trust, the culture that comes around it, the fact that from an economic perspective, they're spending money with farmers that live a very short distance away who are coming back into town and spending their money. And, you know, it's just
a sense of community that comes about with that sort of food exchange.
Yeah, in like real culture and sense of place. So 10 years ago, just it like popped. And now we're at a point where we can make like a half a dozen to a dozen phone calls and have 100% of everything in our cooler. And after 35 years and with all these amazing young men and women coming out and really nailing farm to table now, it's just kind of like I wake up ready to go and I go to bed and fall right asleep. It's pretty cool.
That's Michelle Nishan, whose childhood on a Midwestern farm inspired him to pioneer the farm-to-table movement and change American food policy. When we come back, Michelle reveals how he became a social justice food revolutionary. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Michelle Nishan, a chef whose commitment to local food has changed the way Americans eat. As commonplace as the farm-to-table movement is today, it might surprise you that Michelle spent years lying to his patrons about where their food was coming from. It ate him up inside, but about 10 years ago, people's attitudes towards food changed, which coincidentally is roughly the same time he got involved with Paul Newman, Cool Hand Luke himself. As a financial backer, Paul pushed Michelle into the next phase of his career, CEO of Wholesome Wave, a nonprofit that uses food to benefit local economies and tackle poverty.
He calls me one day and says, Michelle, it's Newman. I need you to come to the theater. So I go there and he's standing at the top of the stairs and you walk up to this little mezzanine where they let you into the theaters, and he had two chairs facing each other and had somebody unscrew every light bulb in the ceiling except the one over the two chairs. So he's like, have a seat. And we sit down just like you and I are across from each other. He's like, would you just please do this goddamn restaurant with me? And by that time I had completely fallen in love with the guy, and I said, okay. for the first time in my life, I had a restaurant where I didn't have to argue with anybody. We believed in the same things. And he's just one of the most humanly genuine people I had ever met. And it's one of the most valuable things I ever did in my life, to be able to really go for something that I believed in with the support of somebody who believed in the same things, but then had proven himself beyond the wealth he was amassing because of his popularity and the way he just turned it back into philanthropic cause and trying to make change. So it was just an amazing thing.
Well, that was only the beginning of what I suspect probably turned into the most rewarding thing for both you and Paul Newman, Wholesome Wave. Tell us about Wholesome Wave and the work you two did together on that.
So it's interesting because when we did the restaurant, I did have, you know, a couple of conditions. One condition was that my wife and my kids could eat there and that Lori could work there, because that's how we met. We met in the business. And the other was that I was trying to do something about people in underserved communities, communities of poverty. I really believe that everybody should have a right to the same tomato or the same peach. Everybody should be able to deliver really great ingredients to their table, regardless of income. We used to be that way in this country. It used to be easy to do that. And he said, well, sounds like a nonprofit to me. Why don't you just found the damn thing? So my feeling was, all of this stuff that was getting bandied about and published back then, because Kellogg Foundation had funded all of these farmers markets and underserved communities, and they were failing without the grant money, and a lot of people assumed that it was because of lack of demand or lack of education. I really felt that it was lack of affordability. So we decided the easiest way to prove whether there was a market or not was just raise private money and double the value of food stamps at farmers markets. So we started in late 2007. By early 2008, we were in 3 states and 8 markets, and it was taking off like wildfire. And within 5 years, we were in like 26 states, close to 300 markets, urban, rural, north, south, east, west, and collecting the stories and proving that consumers in poverty really are consumers, that they do want to feed their families better, that they just don't have the affordability. When we gave them the affordability, they would immediately shift the way they were spending their SNAP, and then provide additional support to small and mid-sized farmers, which are classic American small businesses. And we measured that impact, and we were able to share it in Washington. And the Farm Bill that just passed has $100 million supporting that program now. So we're very proud of that. Wouldn't have happened if Newman didn't say, just like with the restaurant, just like, sounds like a nonprofit to me. Just get off your tuchus and do something about it.
Well, I have to tell you that personally, that is one of the most brilliant pieces of work in food that I have seen in my lifetime. And I have had a lot of up close and personal experience watching the success of that program. Because if I'm correct, Richard McCarthy at the Crescent City Farmers Market was one of your early adapters.
Yeah, absolutely. They were, and they just hit it out of the park. And the interesting thing is, we even learned from them on the evaluation, because they were doing excellent evaluation. Richard's just one of the most brilliant guys in the world. So they were doing, I believe, 4 markets, and we became really fast friends. I remember when Katrina happened, one of our donors, the donor advisor that works with us, said, listen, our anonymous donor wants to do something in the Gulf area. So, I mean, we could have come down here and done something, but what we did was we called Richard and said, hey, Richard, our donor wants us to do something. We'd rather you get the money, you know? So how can we work together? We'll take out of the grant whatever it costs us to maybe fly down and have a couple of meetings, but you guys get the money and do something. So they created this thing for shrimpers to get into farmers markets in communities, get them away from the water,
get them
away from the oil, get them to restaurateurs, get them to see a show, you know, let them.
That was the White Boot Brigade.
Yeah.
Now, who do you think was head of the White Boot Brigade? Me.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Oh, I didn't, that's awesome. I didn't know that.
The White Boot Brigade didn't go anywhere that I didn't go. And in fact, yeah. Alice was so wonderful and generous because she was part of our big hookup on the West Coast when we took
fabulous.
The shrimpers to the West Coast. That was
so
fantastic.
That, you know, it's just brilliant, brilliant people out there. And that's how we work. We have a network of over 60 nonprofits that do the work, now it leads to our other programs, which are, you know, you need those emissaries on the ground. We don't want to be the organization that goes to a community and hangs our shingle out the door. So our nonprofit partners, they call the program whatever they want. The only thing we charge them is that they manage the alternative currency fraud-free, and they have to do the data collection so we can build the case for policy change. You know, whatever the hell you think is best for your community, you've established the trust. You've established the connection with the members in need. They're going to trust you. The best thing that we can do is just put a good idea in your hands and let you run with it. And we're really proud of that.
Now, your latest project is called Doctors as P-H-A-M-E-R-S, Doctors as Farmers. How can doctors that's be right. farmers?
So that's our fruit and vegetable prescription program. Our theory of change is that there are big pots of federal money that are not being spent well. The intention is good. They're not being spent well. If we can shift the way they get spent, we might have a better outcome. So our, you know, our theory with food stamps is if we could get people to spend 40% of their food stamp dollar on locally grown fruits and vegetables, they will be heroes of a changed food system. SNAP was $80 billion last year.
Wow.
$80 billion. If $20 billion of that could go to local food, there aren't enough local food farmers to take care of that. So it could really create system change. So we look at the Affordable Care Act. We look at Medicaid. We look at a variety of policy drivers around pots of money outside of the Farm Bill that could be shifted towards local food. So our whole premise was food is medicine. The prescription pipeline exists. Let's change what's in the pipeline from drugs at the back end to food in the front end. So, again, raising private money, we gather doctors, nutritionists, community health workers, our implementing partners on the ground at the farmers markets, and got them to work as a community of practice, our version of comprehensive care. Before our program, the doctor would see a family and say, you're obese, or overweight, trending obese, your daughter's pre-diabetic, your husband has high blood pressure and is obese. If you guys don't do something to change your diet, the next time I see you, someone's either going to have a heart attack or be diabetic or whatever it might be. Family goes home, they do their food budget, they take a couple of buses, get to a grocery store, they have $2 to spend for dinner for a family of four. A head of broccoli is $2, or an 8-pack of instant noodles is $2, or $1.49. You get four bowls of noodles out of all of that. The husband and wife, that's all they have, and then they buy two little bags of cheese thingies so the kids don't cry hungry before they go to bed. They decide they can't change their diet. So what happens? Someone passes out at work. A year from now, they go back. They have type 2 diabetes, but now that same doctor can give them free diabetes medicine because we won't let somebody perish because they have a chronic disease, right? So what we've done is made it possible. So when the doctor sees that family the first time, says, you need to improve your diet, and here's a prescription to do that. They give the family a prescription, and it's the whole family. So the entire family gets to increase their consumption of fruits and vegetables, a serving per day per person. They have to go to the dietitian or the nutritionist to get the prescription. They get all the health and the coach counseling, you know, increase your physical activity, here's how. Community health worker takes them for the farmer's market tour, introduces them to the farmers and our implementing partner on the ground. They have their prescription. It has a monetary value. They get their fruits and vegetables. And then to get a refill monthly, they have to go back and be measured for health outcomes. And 3 years in a row now, 41% of our index patients have dropped their BMI in a 14-week intervention, where 100% were expected to stay the same or increase their BMI. So we're proving that food is medicine. It's no longer something that we're doing for future generations. I've seen more change in the last 8 years than I had ever hoped to see in a lifetime when I was thinking really big thoughts. You know, so it's awesome.
It is awesome. My last question for you is, you've already proved yourself to be a visionary, a big thinker who thinks out the box and makes it happen. When you look in your crystal ball, what's the goal? What's going to happen next? What is your most outlandish dream for the future?
Okay. So, well, first of all, if I had a crystal ball, I'd win the lottery. That would be awesome. To me, it's less visionary than I think it's common sense. You know, my mom and dad were farmers, and I think all of the activity that we're seeing around these programs just really allows common sense to happen again. There's no such thing in my mind as any parent, unless they're really have a real psychological problem. There's no such thing as a parent who doesn't want the best for their family. We need to get the resources back in the hands of the family unit so that they have the resources to provide the best for their families. And I believe through doing that, because it all has to happen through food, food can save everything. Food can fix human health, environmental health, societal health, economic health. It's the building block of all culture. You know, fix food, you fix everything. And I believe it's these citizens of poverty that are going to be the heroes of our changed food system. That's what I see for the future.
Thank you, Michelle. You are the best. I'm so grateful you took this time to sit down with us. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Michelle Nishan, CEO of Wholesome Wave. If you want to get involved with your community's food scene, Michelle recommends websites like localfood.org or his own, wholesomewave.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. You eat spiders? Louisiana shrimpers have for generations. They eat shrimp spiders. Until recently, this dish was relegated to homes along the bayou, but MoFo's chef, Michael Galata, has them on his menu regularly. I sweet-talked the recipe out of Michael and tweaked it a bit to make them easy to prepare at home. First, use only the freshest shrimp. The shrimp head should be pink without any trace of black at all. Separate the shell from the shrimp body, then dust those shrimp bodies in flour. For this, Michael uses rice flour. He also makes a wash with coconut milk, turmeric, and hot Korean chili flakes, but if I didn't have a can of coconut milk, I'd use regular milk, about a cup with a whole egg beaten in, seasoned with some Louisiana hot sauce. The flour-dusted shrimp spiders go into the wash, then are dredged in cornmeal, what we usually call fish fry in Louisiana, and I don't have to tell you that I'd be using Zatarain's. Drop your shrimp spiders into 360-degree hot oil and fry them for 3 to 4 minutes until they're totally brown and crunchy. Shrimp heads? In the Bayou State, we call them spiders, and they're real Louisiana eats. Dr. Gourmet, internist Tim Harlan, is known for combining good medical sense with delicious eating. Here to talk about one of man's most basic and important seasonings, Dr. Gourmet. Tim, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
It is great to be here, Poppy.
Let's talk salt sense. The human body actually needs some salt to function properly. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. So sodium chloride, which is salt, so one molecule of sodium, one molecule of chloride put together, comes out in that nice white little crystalline substance that we like to put on our food. We do need both of those minerals, actually.
So what does that do for our body? What do we need it for?
Well, you need it for almost everything. It basically helps maintain the body's equilibrium, if you will. It's one of the major minerals in the body, or solutes, that keeps the rest of the liquid from being too thin or too thick. Might be a good way to think about it. But at the same time, sodium is also one of the major transmitters in the body and moving fluid across different membranes, etc. So there's just a host of different reasons we've got to have sodium to survive. Our bloodstream is about the same degree of saltiness as seawater.
When does salt become dangerous for humans?
Well, I think the challenge with salt and the challenge with sodium is we eat too much of it. Right now, the average American eats about 6,000 milligrams of sodium a day, so that's about 2.5 teaspoons. And actually, some people eat well into the 10,000 milligrams, so call it 4 teaspoons of salt per day. You know, salt has been traditionally a preservative, and a great preservative, you know, for pickled goods, for fermented goods, fermented foods, etc. So we tend to like salt and we tend to like salty foods because those we need that sodium, and it's sort of like sugar. When we taste it, it sends little signals to our brain that says, well, this is salty, I need some of this salt. And so we're a little more apt to eat it as a result of that.
Now, I don't think anybody's actually sitting down with 2.5 teaspoons of salt. So how are they consuming that?
Well, the majority of the sodium and the majority of the salt that we consume in America is in junk food. Potato chips, crackers, cookies, cakes, pies, a lot of things that you would think of that are really sweet. Bread has a lot of sodium in it, actually, cheeses, but mostly processed junk foods, fast foods, things that are on the shelf like, you know, canned beef stews, canned soups, those sorts of things. It's traditionally, again, been used as a preservative, and food processors like to use sodium for a number of different reasons. Number one, it does help preserve the food. But the other thing is we are more and more and more used to eating that sodium, so that people require higher triggers over the course of the last 40 years. A lot more salt in the foods today than there were 40 and 50 years ago.
Well, I know they don't call you Dr. Gourmet by accident. You really know your way around the kitchen. Do you have any food chemistry tips, any substitutions up your sleeve that will people who are on no salt diets that might make things more palatable for them?
There's a few things. Number one, fresh, fresh, fresh. Make it fresh. So if you're adding in fresh oregano, fresh thyme, fresh chives, you get that incredible fresh herb hit. You know, spices, if you're going to use great Cajun spices, you actually need less sodium because you've got so many other fantastic flavors. The second trick I would say is umami foods, mm-hmm. Okay? So that's the fifth taste bud. You know, you have salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and umami, which is savory like mushrooms and Parmesan cheese and meat. Umami flavors need less salt.
That's
and
great.
Then the third piece, and I'll say this again, I'll repeat it. Measure the amount of sodium you're putting in because you need some salt in your food to help it taste great. We've done a lot of taste tests in the Dr. Gourmet kitchen, and I don't have, this is not science, but one of the things that I strive for my low-sodium dishes is that it has at least about 300 milligrams or 350 milligrams of sodium. It seems that 300 milligram is the break point for a serving. So if you're going to, say, have some stew or red beans and rice, you need about 300 milligrams of sodium to activate the salt sensors on the taste bud. And you need that. You know, otherwise the food is bland. And I don't want you eating bland food. I want you eating great food that just happens to be great for you.
I just want to say thank you so much for this very interesting conversation about something so simple as salt.
It is always a joy to be with you.
Please come back with more good sense eating for us, will you?
Absolutely.
Dr. Gourmet, Tim Harlan. Do you know the difference between white shrimp and brown shrimp? We'll answer that question when we come right back, so don't go anywhere.
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly, and the spiders from Mars. They played it left hand, but made it too far.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the difference between white shrimp and brown shrimp? Lucky for us, both are plentiful in our Louisiana coastal waterways. White shrimp are bigger and have a longer season, generally from April through December. Because of their size, White shrimp usually fetch a higher price at the dock, but real shrimp lovers look forward to the annual springtime opening of brown shrimp season. Although slightly smaller, brown shrimp have a unique sweetness and a slightly firmer texture. They're simply shrimpier. In fact, with their golden brown color and incredible flavor, they're sometimes referred to as Louisiana Gold. Whether you're choosing white or brown shrimp, just for goodness sake, make sure they come from our local waters, because friends don't let friends eat imported shrimp. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eat. Longtime friends and colleagues Toby Rodriguez and Brian Kaiser share a number of creative interests, but their number one passion is preserving native Acadian foodways. Together, they travel the country with Lâche Pas Boucherie, the Lafayette-based Butcher's Roadshow founded by Toby, promoting the Cajun practice of the boucherie. We caught up with Toby and Brian on Frenchman Street, where the two were preparing for a Cajun cuisine and music pop-up at Three Muses Restaurant that evening. I asked them to describe what they think makes Cajun food so unique.
I would say Cajun food is absolutely not what most of the world thinks Cajun food is. It's not something that's overly spiced. It is not something that comes from directly from Acadie or Nova Scotia. It's something that over the past 200 years has evolved, accepting in multiple cultures. I'm a Rodriguez. Brian is a Kaiser. This is a Canary Islander and a German, you know. But with both of us, with having very strong Acadian roots folded into those last names.
There's so many different styles and fashions. Toby and I grew up in two different places. Him, the bayou, me on the coast. So our cooking styles are different. It's the same dishes. It's the same foundations. You know, we have our Trinity and we have our roux. That's definitely ours. Cajun food is what we cooked growing up, what our grandparents taught us how to cook, what their parents taught them how to cook. It's the traditions that we were brought up with.
Toby, when did it click for you that your food and your culture was really separate and different from the rest of the world?
I think traveling, I guess about 7 years ago, I did a 6-week backpacking trip across Europe. And one of my main focuses in that trip was to eat. Going to Europe not only showed me how different our food was, because like everywhere else in America, besides maybe New York and New Orleans, like for me, the food just sucked. I mean, it just wasn't like, didn't like stand up to par with what we had at home. And then I went to Europe and like I had some really amazing dishes. I had some of the best dishes in my life, but also in those dishes saw a bunch of our roots. I saw like where things came from. And like, I think I came back from that trip, maybe not as much consciously, but definitely subconsciously, seeking more of a role in cuisine. One thing that I have witnessed the past few years is that a tradition that was already dwindling and dying out when I was a kid had pretty much almost died, was the tradition of the boucherie, which is like the, in my opinion, like one of the highest levels of Cajun cooking, because you're actually butchering the animal and there's so many dishes that come out of it. And, you know, let's say, like, so I grew up doing this, but like 5 years ago, started like getting back into it and doing it actively. And 5 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of people doing it. There wasn't a whole lot of people who were interested in it. And now it seems that like that tradition has been plucked out of the trash can. There's a lot of people that are interested in it, a lot of people that are actually doing it now. Like, we're not the only ones doing boucheries anymore. There are other teams, there are other groups of people from our area that are doing it now. And I'm like, that makes me really, really happy.
That's fantastic. This must have been something that you didn't grow up going to. You didn't go to a boucherie down on the coast, did you?
We had a few. I don't think it was as much as where Toby grew up, because we were more of a seafood-oriented culture, where it's definitely more of a farming, farm raising and animals where Toby's from. So, but we did have, you know, the coastal Cajuns, they like pork as well. So there were a few pig roasts that went on and that I participated in growing up. It's something that I'm really proud to be involved in. It's such a natural part of us as being humans that we've lost. And so many people are used to, you know, going to the store and getting packaged meat. They don't know where it came from. They don't know where it's been. And that's a big fight right now I see in our society, where people are kind of rising up and saying, hey, we don't want, you know, this processed meat, this stuff that's been treated badly. We don't know where it's coming from. So, you know, part of that magic with this is getting on a personal level with that animal and being in my natural state as a human, you know, and that sacrifice of its life to give us life. It's about as real as you can get.
I'd like to go back to the beginning of your shared story, because I'm really fascinated about how the two of you all came together, and it has to do with so much more than just food.
Absolutely. Toby and I share a lot of the same creative interests. The good thing about our relationship is we're very much the same and very different. We keep each other on our toes and off our toes. It's a nice balance between the two of us.
Me and Brian are both visual artists. We're both carpenters, both, you know, built furniture and draft and sculpt and also cook. And we're neighbors and best friends.
We were both doing the same things, just in different places. And I had been looking to get into more of an outlet where people were more accepting as to what we're doing now, whereas what I was doing on the coast wasn't accepted as much as it is in the Lafayette area. People are more interested there in preserving the culture, which is what we are trying to accomplish. And it's sad to say, more where I'm from, people are more interested in making money and getting ahead and just getting a big truck or a big TV. They don't want to come out and dance anymore. They don't want to spend that time. They don't want to put all that love and effort into what they grew up with. But I found that in that area, and I'm just happy to be a part of that.
The group of people that we have with us, I'm very, very fortunate and very grateful that those people believe in what me and Brian are doing. Some extremely talented people that we owe a lot to for getting us where we are. And a really ragtag bunch of misfits too, which we fit totally in with.
Where has Lashpa been, and where are you going?
I think our first major gig was Brooklyn in Red Hook. We did a festival in Brooklyn. We did a guest chef spot there. We worked for like our butts off like 7 days, like piled all our equipment in the back of a purple Astro minivan.
Almost popping a wheelie. We had so much cast iron in the back. We drove sagging all the way to Brooklyn.
We had a little guy that we brought with us helping us, and he got drunk a bunch of times and fell asleep with his pants down on the toilet. Brian had to go slap him around, wake him up. We've come a long ways. Thank you, Zach. From there, we did Top Chef in New Orleans. I went to Alaska this past summer. We went to Vermont, to Montpelier, Vermont, which we're going back in August. It looks like there might be a boucherie that we're setting up in San Francisco and another one in Houston. And always a whole bunch of work in Lafayette. Because of the amazing talents that we've been working with recently, I guess around October, we've been embraced by the Lafayette culinary community and have found ourselves in this vortex of talent. And because of that, we've been influenced, we've learned new things, we've been exposed to new techniques. Manny Ogiello, who is with Bread and Circus, two boucheries ago in November pointed out that I was throwing the cow fat away. And he pulled it out the bucket and says, "You're throwing this away. Well, we need to make sausage with it." And I kind of looked at him funny and I was like, "Okay, well, show me what you're talking about." So now, like, cow fat sausage has become a staple for our boucherie. And then we've taken it and gone a little step further. Yesterday, we always do boudin noir, which is blood boudin. We did some boudin noir dumplings wrapped in cow fat and smoked it.
So, lashpa. What does that mean, both literally and now figuratively?
Lashpa was a phrase that I grew up with. I think a lot of Cajuns grew up with that phrase in their household. Something my grandfather used to always say. But basically, lashpa means to hold on. Like, lashpa means not to do, like to not let go. If you think about our culture, you think about what we've come from as a culture, what we've survived. It's like should be the Cajun mantra in a way. So what we're doing is we're preserving, yes, but we're also evolving. Like that's like the true meaning for me of like holding on to our culture. We definitely have an intention in preserving, but no culture survives within a glass box. You have to grow, you have to evolve. And I'd like to say that lashpa is definitely doing that from the culinary side and you know, and inspiring in other disciplines also. One thing that I've seen since from my generation to the next is that there's a lack of cooks coming out of homes, and due to Americanization, due to people like, you know, getting more takeout and, you know, just eating out more and not cooking at home as much, younger kids, you know, going into college, don't know how to cook. And I come from a town where I would say 95% of the people that came out of that high school knew how to cook, at least cook a rice and gravy. I'm hoping that through what we're doing and through the efforts of many others, that we can get that to be something that comes back. That because food is big now, food's a major part of pop culture right now, and hoping that those traditions will be brought back into the household and that families will start to sit around the table a little bit more. And, you know, a husband or a wife can be in the kitchen cooking for their kids instead of going through a drive-through.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for coming out of the kitchen and having this visit with us on busy Frenchman Street in New Orleans, where you brought the country to the city. So thanks for doing this for me. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you, Poppy.
Bien merci, Poppy.
Toby Rodriguez and Brian Kaiser of Lashpa Boucherie. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week for a beer tasting with Polly Watts of the Avenue Pub.
We give menu descriptions and we tell people things they could look for as a guide for, you know, are you going to like it before you order it? But every person's palate is completely different, and women's are dramatically different than men. They taste different things in the same beer. And you can put all kinds of wacky descriptors on something, but it comes down to, when I finish that glass, did I enjoy that experience or did I not?
Subscribe to our podcast. Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, and Linda Green, the Yakima and Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.